Kevin, I got to tell you, before we start the show, I thought of you this week. Phil Mickelson wins the PGA at 50 years old. And I said, Martin's got to come back, man. You got to come back, Martin. Hey, did you watch it? Wasn't that an outstanding story?
I definitely watched it. I loved every minute of it. And there is no chance of a comeback.
Hanson, you might come back then, right? You could do it. You're in better shape than anybody.
Actually, I'm considering it, Jim, in my next life.
Okay. We got lots to talk about, man. Warren, this is a great show for you because it's all about the mixed doubles that, you know, that wrapped up this week. And boy, if you're a curling fan, you got to love the last couple of months. So we're going to talk about that and a lot more coming up.
Last rock, eighth end, up by two.
I don't think I'm white.
I don't think you are either.
Oh,
it's clean.
Don't kill it, Ben.
Line's really good.
Line's good. Right on the button, guys. Right
here. Last stone for Kevin Martin. They want it on the button. The sweepers are watching it. Fans are on their feet. Kevin Martin goes out as a champion. Cuts him to one. He will win his final Grand Slam, taking the Players' Championship. Talk about putting an exclamation mark at the end of a career. All he had to do was cut him down. Kevin Martin can celebrate. He is a champion.
As I said at the top of the show, as we get rolling here, it's been all about the mixed doubles. The world mixed doubles ended this week, but there's a couple of interesting points that have come out of it, which we have to discuss. There's been a fair amount of buzz this week on our Facebook page about how to bring new teams into the fold that are below the ranking of the top 12 to 15 of the world. There's been lots of ideas put forward by this, which we want to discuss. And we've got another guest, Phil Drobnik, who is now the head of the U.S. Mixed Doubles program. Let's start with you, Warren. Give us your update, your feel for it. It must be, Warren, before we start, it must be a proud moment for you with all the mixed doubles that happened, because this was your baby, and I thought about you all week, and what a wonderful thing you did for curling, because people absolutely love the mixed doubles, Warren.
Yeah, it is kind of funny. Every time I watch a mixed doubles game, I think back to the thought process, and we put that whole thing together a little over 20 years ago, and it's quite amazing as to where it started and where it's going. So, yeah, it feels good to know that sport is catching on in the manner of which it is. I think one thing that we determined for sure this past week, there's little question who the number one curler on the planet is at the moment, and that's Bruce Mowat from Scotland. Take a look at what he's done since March. World Men's Silver, Humpney's Cup Champion, Players' Championship Champion, World Mixed Doubles, gold. It doesn't get much better than that, and this guy is really on fire, and it's going to be interesting to see if he can keep this going into next year. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, I'd hate to bet against Bruce right now. You see all over Twitter, Bruce Almighty. You know, he's unbelievable. But, you know, we got to congratulate, of course, Jennifer Dodds as well, Bruce's partner in the mixed doubles. But let's go through mixed doubles a little bit. We've got, of course, the gold medalists, silver medalists, Kristin Skaslien and Magnus Nedergotten out of Norway, bronze medal, Almeida Devel, and of course, one of the best players in the world, definitely Oscar Erixon. Fourth place, Carrie Anderson, of course, and Brad Guju. Now, those are the final four, but remember that when it comes to qualifying for the Olympic Games, it's actually the top seven. The top six have made the playoffs, and then there was the one extra playoff game between the Czech Republic and the USA. So Italy, Stefania Constantini and Amos Massner, they came in fifth. Switzerland, Jenny Perret and Martin Rios. They're always a tough mixed doubles team, the Swiss pair. And of course, a huge congratulations for me for the to the Czech Republic. You know, just a huge win for the country and for their curling program. Zuzana Polova and Thomas Paul winning that game against the U.S. to guarantee them a spot in the Olympic Games in Beijing. So congratulations to all. And I want to also, you know, send out a congrats to the World Curling Federation for getting this, the whole thing done. Like, there were so many questions, so many naysayers back in January and early February, right before the bubble was going to start, and the World Curling Federation, they pulled it all off along with, of course, the mixed doubles in Aberdeen. And of course, Curling Canada stepped in along with the Grand Slam of Curling and made it all happen in the Calgary bubble, as well as the volunteers. You know what? It was an amazing thing to be able to, from the start to the finish. And of course, I know that everybody had their fingers crossed across the curling world going, okay, please, you know, let's get it through. Let's get through this. We need all these qualifiers to happen for all this qualifying for the Olympics, because if it wouldn't have happened, how do you decide what nations are going to play in the Olympic Games in men's, women's, and mixed curling? So, you know, it was really important. I watched quite a lot of the mixed doubles this week. The ice was fantastic. And Tom Brewster, of course, a great curler in Scotland, him and his crew did a terrific job. And you know what? It was, I think, an all-around success for the last, well, it started February 15th, I think, with the Scotties. So 3.5 months of curling between the Calgary bubble and Scotland. And fantastic. I just want to make sure I shout out a big congrats to everyone.
Just want to go back to that game between the Czech Republic and the USA for a second. Certainly, I felt bad for Tabitha Peterson and Joe Polo, the American side, who I know those two people, and they're great players. But the emotion from that Czech team when they won that game was just absolutely fabulous, because I'm assuming that's the first time that Czech Republic will have any kind of a team in the Olympics. And so they're going to be in the Olympics for the first time, and the emotion that came from both of those people was phenomenal. I think I should also mention, of course, China is also going to be part of that mixed doubles playoff. So that's the eighth spot. And there's going to be two more spots decided. All the teams that were playing in Scotland that did not qualify into the eight will be playing off sometime probably in December at a site yet to be determined, to determine the two more spots. And of course, the two U.S. players who didn't make it, or the U.S. representative, will be there as well to try and get them a spot in Beijing.
So is that wide open, Warren? Anyone can go to that last qualifier?
From what I understand, just the teams that were in Aberdeen that didn't qualify will be able to play in the final playoff.
Great job, Kev. What about, can we get a comment about Team Canada, Brad Gushue and Kerry Anderson? What do you take away from their result?
I don't think they played at the top of the game. In the Canadian mixed doubles championship, both Brad and Kerry played a higher percentage than they did at the world mixed doubles. But that happens with athletes. You don't always play at the absolute top of your game. And they weren't quite there this time, but solidified the spot in the Olympics. Got into the playoff round and just came up a little bit short. But I don't think so. Other than one important part is that Brad had only played mixed doubles a little bit, and Kerry, this was her first time at it. So to win Canada and then go on to the Worlds and represent us very well, in my opinion, was really well done. And one thing that we have to look at, and I know Warren is chomping at the bit to talk about this, and that's mixed doubles in general in Canada. I kind of think, how can we not have more people playing mixed doubles more often, and certainly our kids coming up, not just a junior, but starting at, you know, how much fun would it be at 12 years old to play mixed doubles or even doubles? Fantastic. We just need to take a serious look at mixed doubles and like why we're ignoring it. It bewilders me. Like, everybody's wondering why Brad and Kerry didn't win. Well, Kerry just had never really played it before. Not her fault.
I think overall in Canada, we have to start paying more attention to mixed doubles as far as, first of all, how do we put these teams together at the top end? And I'm assuming what's happening as well, because there's a few teams that are becoming mixed double specialists, along with some of these top teams are combining, as we saw with Brad and Kerry. But I think more effort has to be put into trying to, I believe, shape the teams of mixed double players going forward. I think there's need for more mixed doubles competitions, which, again, are very thin. And I think maybe some of these major events, maybe even the Grand Slams as we move forward, could end up having a mixed doubles component at the front end or back end of maybe starting with one slam event. I think there's got to become a mixed doubles junior championship, and maybe even men's doubles and a women's doubles. That hasn't been talked about much. And just because it hasn't been part of the whole saga to this point in time, there's no reason why that can't start to happen. Or it can become mixed up doubles. It can be men, woman, two men, two women, however you wish it. And the game overall, I think, embraced more in Canada, because I also look at it as being a very important thing with curling clubs going forward. I know the complaint is, well, it's only four people rather than eight, but there's ways of working around it. And I think it's, again, one of the things we can use to hook new people into the game because of its quick, It's high scoring. It's engaging. And those are the things I think it has to be.
Warren, you got to be pleased, though, with the profile that the mixed doubles got over the last several weeks. I mean, if they couldn't get more exposure than what happened over the last few weeks, and certainly that's got to help grow the sport.
Yeah, the profile has been very good. This again goes back to the fact that mixed doubles has not been part of the season champions prior to this year, and I doubt if we hadn't had the COVID situation whether it would have been this year. So I really think Curling Canada has to figure out a way going forward that it's going to be part of the season champion schedule and be one of the events in there, and that's maybe a start of making it a little more prevalent. I think this was probably the first year we even got the kind of world coverage that we did on it in Canada. So I think those aspects all have to be made bigger and better, and with it, it will grow.
Kev, do you think it will get to a point where if you're going to concentrate on mixed doubles, that's all you'll be able to do? What's up with, say, Olympics? Are you going to be able to curl in both?
I think you'll curl in both. I don't think a person would be just one or the other, at least not in the next, 10, 20 years. Now, it may get mixed doubles, way, way bigger. Well, if it does, then I guess people can worry about that. But right now, you've got Bruce Mowat, who's certainly, number one right now. I can't imagine why Scotland or Great Britain in the Olympic Games wouldn't want him. Anytime you can possibly have him throwing, that's a good thing. You have a much better chance of winning a medal. So I don't think there's any reason why people wouldn't play both. The four-person curling is certainly the biggest sport right now, definitely draws the biggest sponsorship. So your top curlers are going to play four-person curling. No question, just because, of course, it makes financial sense. Mixed doubles is so much fun. And the top players, how could you not play mixed doubles anyways? Just for the fun of it. And then, of course, at the end of the road, there's an Olympic medal sitting there. So I think the top players will play both. And it's just a battle as to who gets to the Olympics in the four-person curling first. And then if the countries deem it possible, in Canada's case, they don't allow you to play both. Other countries do allow you to play both. It's really up to the country and the rules that they set. But say in Canada's case, you battle it out for four-person curling. The teams that don't make it, you go with your mixed doubles pair. And you go in and you try to win the mixed doubles trials and go to the Beijing that way.
It'll be interesting to see. I'm surprised, Kev, you said it will take so long, 10 to 20 years, to get it up to where Warren would like to see it.
Oh, I want to see it too. But things don't change really fast when it comes to sponsorship and television coverage and covering all these various events. And maybe it'll be quicker than that. But, the Olympic cycle is every 4 years. And I just can't see it being quicker than a couple of Olympic cycles before the prize money's big enough where people can just do mixed doubles without playing the four-person game. Do you see that, Warren?
I think it's got the potential to move forward in that fashion, because I think as it gets more ingrained into the fabric of curling in not just Canada, but the world, it's going to become more popular, because I find it, like you suggest, very entertaining. Man, with just 10 rocks being thrown, I can't believe in some of those ends how many rocks are in play. And it's all towards the middle. And it's always been my theory for a long, long time, is the most entertaining curling is going to be when you play towards the middle, which is why that game was developed the way it has been. And I think anytime you get play towards the middle, that's how you score multiple times, and it's where you're going to probably see the most exciting shots. And so I think as that grows and people become more aware of that, it's going to be gaining in popularity, and I think it's going to be right up there with four-person curling, maybe quicker than we might think, because it's gotten a lot of visibility this year that it hadn't had before. So I think that's going to make a difference.
Do you think four-man curling, Warren, will look at this and go, maybe we should look at some of these ideas that they're doing because people like it, and they keep saying it's a lot more fun to watch?
Yes, it's interesting you bring that up, because I've thought about that. I've done some playing with things of thinking, what if we started off each end in four-person curling with two position stones, maybe not the same as mixed doubles, but position rocks, and we threw seven rocks a team per end rather than eight, and you decide who's only going to throw their one rock, and maybe that can change every end. So I've thought about that. There's probably some other considerations that could be put in there as well, but maybe going forward, those type of things could become reality. You'll only know any of these things if you start experimenting with them and see how they work out and see what it changes.
Our guest is going to be Phil Drobnik coming up, in a few minutes. He is the head of the U.S. Mixed Doubles Program, and we'll be interested in asking him a bunch of stuff that was just brought up here about what they're doing in the States, how the program works, how are they dealing with younger people, getting them involved, and a lot more. So email us, insidecurling@gmail.com. Keep them short, though. Keep them short. There's a chance you'll get on the show. Twitter, @CurlingInside, Facebook, @InsideCurling, and Instagram, @InsideCurlingPodcast. Thanks for everyone for your emails. There's been a fair amount of buzz this week on our Facebook page about how to bring new teams into the fold that are below the ranking of 12 to the 15th spot in the world. You know, one of the interesting points is most of the curlers winning major events and titles are not youngsters. If we take a look at some of the people having success, one of the women's side, Alina Petz, she's 31. Anna Hasselborg is 32. Rachel Holman is 32. Carrie Anderson is 31. Nika Dean is 35. Brendan Botcher is 29. Kevin Cooey is 46. Holy man. And Brad Gushue is 40. What are some of your thoughts, Kev, about all this?
I have some different thoughts on this. I don't think you change the events, the big events as of today, the Grand Slams. You want to keep a tight field because you want the best of the best. And that's not a place to cut your teeth, I don't think. But the World Curling Tour events are. But I think a really important stride that we as a sport needs to make is improving our streaming of curling. I know Sportsnet Now is fantastic, and we just need more and more curling on it. And that can come from the World Curling Tour. And that's just a matter of setting up a screening service to all the various events. And I think that would really help bring notoriety to teams that are playing on the tour, because then you're getting it streamed all over the world. And all of a sudden, there's going to be household names come from, if you want to call it, the Tier 2 group before they take the step up into Tier 1 and into the Grand Slams and World Championships, Olympics, and so on. So I think that's kind of probably a really good answer to this question of how do we get these young people more competitive and get them some money in their jeans so that they can travel enough and be able to compete. And I think the worldwide curling streaming is a huge answer for it. And there'll be more information on that in the next few weeks. Stay tuned, everybody.
Warren, why do you think that almost like it's a negative thing that these champions are too old? You know, Phil Mickelson, for example, wins this week. I can't think of anything bigger for the game than young kids watching an older person win a championship saying, hey, I could stay at this thing for a long time.
Well, except if you look at golf, most of the guys winning these days are pretty young. They're in their early 20s for the most part. So I think we don't see that in curling. If we take a look back through time, and if we look at the Brier, Kerry Bertnick was the youngest player to ever win the Brier in 1981. And he was 22 years old. No one has even scared that since then. We can go back even farther. Ron Anton played third for Hector Gervais in 1961 and won the Brier, and he was 19 years old. We haven't come anywhere near seeing anybody in that age category for years in that winning circle. Maybe there's ways that the next-gen development that's taking place right now, the U25, U24, those things will all help. But I think, without question, there is a need for an obvious Tier 2 development. And I know there's those amongst our Facebook group that feel strongly that everybody should be lumped into that top level and you just play off and see who come out. While that might help development, I don't agree that this is the most advantageous route for the sport to be taken. And I don't think there really is a solid route right now that does exist. Some of our Facebook fans seem to think this should be Sportsnet's responsibility to develop this aspect. But I don't believe it is. Sportsnet has done a great job of showcasing the top players in the game, and they're a private company, and I think they're doing a great job at that. But Curling Canada and WCF in particular, but Curling Canada needs to be the ones that step forward and begin to, I think, better develop the Tier 2 aspect. And not to say that I don't think that Sportsnet might not be part of that if they were approached and discussed, but I do believe that that whole end of things needs to be tuned up to some degree. I think the other interesting thing that takes place is, in Canada anyway, our manner of how people come up through the game today is to a very large degree by chance. And because of, as well, our provincial territorial guidelines, very hard for a player to venture outside the borders of their province going forward under our current structure. I think it starts with probably developing a good evaluation system, which I'm not aware of existing, that evaluates players at the technical level, at the psychological level, and at the physiological level, probably starting at a very young age, probably around 14, 15. And it probably needs to be updated every couple of years in a camp of some sort. So you begin to build a book on the players so you know who's who. And I think as these players move forward, I think Curling Canada needs to be helping them as well in the development and putting together of teams. Again, I believe without boundaries from a provincial point of view. And I think after a period of time with that approach, you're going to see younger teams developed quicker and built solid, far more solid at a young age versus now you kind of have to go through the mill yourself. And I even go back to when I was playing, Kevin probably can say the same thing. When you're coming up through the ranks, you just hope that some good player or good skip might see you and say, hey, I think that guy's a pretty good player, because there was no other way of kind of moving through the system. And I think the whole thing has to be more calculated. I think when we talk to Phil Drobnik later today, as far as the United States are concerned, they're doing things slightly differently than Canada is. And from the point of view of, again, moving their players forward kind of as a group and helping them develop teams. And I think it's paying off for them so far with regard to the type of competency they're developing, particularly with some of the younger teams.
Well, if I want to step back into my time, the way you got a good team together is, and it was well known, you had to go to the Northern Alberta Institute of Technology, go to school there. That's where Jules Ochar was the coach, and he would put teams together. And so I didn't know. So our Canadian junior team that we won the Canadians with, Rick Feeney, throwing third, I had never met him. Dan Petrick, throwing second, never met him. Mike Berger at lead, never met him. But I went to Nate and tried out for the team. And Jules would have more than one team anyway, but the main team. And he put the team together. Like, he put myself and Rick and Dan and Mike. And Mike was from Burstall, Saskatchewan, very, very small town in southern Saskatchewan. And then Rick Feeney was from Sexsmith, Alberta, way up by Grand Prairie. Dan Petrick from Smoky Lake, and I was from Lougheed, Alberta, nowhere near each other. So none of us knew each other at all. And we put the team together, and we won, and Dan and I curled together. Geez, we curled in a couple of Olympics together even after that. We stayed together for years. So to your point, Warren, it does make a lot of sense. And we do need to have a junior curling camp structure, not a lot different than, I guess, what my curling academies are. Rob Kreps and myself now have been doing it, I don't even know, 13, 14 years. We've been doing two camps a year. And really, what we do is evaluate the talent. And, you know, Jules is old now, so he doesn't worry as much about building teams at Nate like he used to. But I'll tell you who does, and that's Rob Kreps. And he basically built the Botcher team, who's doing pretty darn good. Carson Sturme team, who are very strong, but younger. The Kelsey Rock team, who are very good. Vel Sweeting's team that she used to have, not with Carrie Anderson, but her previous team with Dana and Rochelle. So that's kind of what's going on in Alberta now. And we run these academies, bring all the kids from across Canada, some from the U.S. in, and we do evaluate them actually, but not on a national level, because I'm not involved with Curling Canada at all. I've never been invited into the fold at all. So we just do this ourselves. And Krepsi and I have been partners in this for now 12, 13, 14 years, and it's terrific. So we just need to do the same kind of thing in a couple of camps across Canada, and not for that reason, but to get all these kids knowing each other. If Jim from Winnipeg is this young phenom guy at 14 years old, but there's one in BC and one in Alberta, make sure these guys meet each other, get to know each other. They may be our next Olympic chance. Like, it doesn't matter where they're from. I don't think the game's past that now. I don't think anybody cares what province people are from anymore. You just get the best teams you can together and you try to win.
Curling Canada's never contacted you?
No, I've never been invited into the coaching at Curl Canada, instructing, nothing. Nope, zero.
Well, how about that for a start, Warren? Okay, to get to develop curling. If I'm Curling Canada, Warren, I'm walking into the office today going, get Scotland on the phone, okay? Let's find out what they're doing. Do we know other programs around the world, Warren? Do you know of it that are, you know, in the forefront of great junior development programs?
I'm not familiar with any of the details. I think when we talk to Phil later, he'll tell us a little bit about the USA one, and it's fairly advanced. I'm pretty sure Switzerland is into the same type of thing, and probably Scotland. And Kevin might know what's happening in Asia, in Japan and Korea. I'm sure they must be doing similar types of things.
Well, you've got Japan, you've got J.D. Lind, who's absolutely fantastic as an instructor coach running the program. You've got in China, Pia Lindholm, who built that extremely strong Swedish program. That's who's running the program there. And then Peter Gallant, Brett Gallant's dad, who coached in South Korea, that's who is running or coaching some of, or I'm not sure how many, I want to make sure I'm right. So definitely coaching in South Korea. I'm not exactly sure to what degree and with if it's just with Eunjun Kim or with all of the teams. I don't know the answer to that. But these places, and when it comes to Scotland, you're mentioning Scotland, Eve Muirhead was coached for many years by Glenn Howard. And you've got Wayne Madaw involved in Sweden with Anna Hasselborg's team. So I think that a lot of these nations around the world have grabbed on to some really high Canadian talent and have really improved their programs that way.
Okay, good stuff, boys. I love this quick email, Warren, that we got. Janice Ainsworth writes us, long-time curler, long-time fan, long-time club volunteer. Of course, I am watching the mixed doubles. Carrie's sweeping every rock, hers and Gushu's. Brad, on the other hand, sits in the hack calling line. Come on, man, she says. Didn't Gushu make the deal, though, Warren? Didn't he say, okay, if I'm doing this, I ain't freaking sweeping?
When we had him on last week, I think he was pretty clear that when he teamed up with Carrie, he made it clear to her that she was doing most of the sweeping because his bod was a little too beat up to be out there leaning in the brush on every stone. So I think that was a pre-competition deal.
Brad always gets everybody's always, oh, I love that Brad Gushu. I love Brad Gushu. This is great to have somebody say, come on, Brad. That's perfect.
That's every curler's dream, you know. Yeah, I ain't sweeping. Okay. Tanner Nathan drops us an email. Hello, Warren. Keeping this short. Adding tie games to an event just to help scheduling is a terrible idea. Watching 2.5 hour games just for it to end in a tie. Talk about boring. How does that not come up in that discussion? We want to add excitement to the games. Letting them end in ties is the exact opposite of excitement. I'm enjoying the interviews, and that's from Tanner.
I think probably we didn't fully explain that whole concept of how to deal with ties. So what you would do is, at the end of the game, if it was tied, each side would get 1 point. You would then draw the button for a second point. So for a win with a draw to the button, you'd get 2 points. But for a regular win, without going into any draw the button or anything else, you'd get three. So there would be a differentiation, much like the same thing the NHL does. So it would be tie broken, or definite win. And you would know who's won the game. Somebody would still win at the end of the game.
Kevin, you've talked about great comebacks. I keep bugging you. I think you should come, Kevin. We talked about Phil Mickelson doing this. There's other great stories about great comebacks in the sport. Wayne Madaw, maybe one of the biggest comebacks, Kevin. They had mentioned a little bit when we saw him at the Briar about his accident, Kevin. But he had a terrible accident. Would have thrown him out of the game, Kevin, virtually?
Well, yeah, and it's just, you know, he's healed well, obviously, and he's playing pretty good golf, too. I was texting with Wayne, Jesus, morning or last night, and he said he shot 70 the day before. Gee whiz. So shoots under par. So he's just one of those kinds of athletes that can play. But it's not really a comeback, I don't think, for Wayne. He just, Glenn got hurt. Wayne went to the Briar and ended up, you know, having to play. And, Wayne is just a brilliant curler and almost carried the team all the way to the finish line. Other than just, you know, his body was starting to shut down a little bit at the end. It had went through a lot, and he hadn't curled much in the last few years, so it was tough. But yeah, what a huge event that the Briar for Wayne Madaw and for curling in general, because everybody's cheering him on. We were all enjoying watching him make all those crazy shots.
I mean, he was a sentimental favorite, and if you think back when I first met Wayne and started coming around the Briar, he was kind of curling's bad boy. Remember, of course, flipping the bird, right? He became more famous for that, throwing his finger up than he did throwing a rock. The reason I bring it up is we've lined up Wayne Madda to come on the show next week. A lot of people have been asking for that. So we're super, super happy to finally get that done. And if you'd like to ask Wayne a question, drop us an email and we'll try to get it on air, and we'll try and ask Wayne that. That'll be next week that we're going to do this. So once again, you can email us insidecurling@gmail.com, and we'd love to take your questions for Wayne Madda coming on next week. So it's time to bring on our guest, Phil Drobnik. He is the director of the U.S. Mixed Doubles and Men's Curling Program. Phil, it's great to have you on. How did all that come about, Phil, and when did you make that decision that you were going to take on coaching?
Yeah, I started back at coaching in 2006 when Chris Plies had reached out to me and said their team needed some help and they were looking for a coach. They wanted someone that was younger and more tuned with the game, and was asking if I'd be willing to work with them and try to help their new team to win a national championship. And I said yes, and that was pretty much the start of my coaching career. I had a cousin that curled, Matt Prusik, who curled with Chris Plies back then, and then Anders Borsen and Matt Hamilton. So it was, a pleasure to work with those guys. We ended up winning 3 national championships, a world championship, and a bronze medal at the world championships. So it was a great 3 years, and I just really enjoyed what I did. And I've always said the pinnacle of coaching is to be able to watch athletes reach their dreams. And I've got to do that a number of times. And it's just such a great feeling to be able to see athletes that dream about winning, a national championship or a world championship or an Olympic gold medal. And as a coach, you sit there firsthand, being able to help them and give them all the information and the guidance that they need to be able to get there. But then to be able to watch them live that dream, it's just a really cool feeling.
Out of all your accomplishments, of course, you were the coach of the United States men's team at both the 2010 Winter Olympics and the 2018 Winter Olympics. I don't know who won that 2010 thing, but anyway, who cares?
I don't remember that one either.
Yeah.
For those of us who've been fans of curling for such a long time, and now we're, the coaches are ever present, sitting at the end of the sheet, watching the games, coming onto the ice when decisions have to be made. What do you do off the ice with the coaching?
Yeah, there's a number of things, all from, working with teams to get their systems set up, whether it be technically, tactically, whether it be team dynamics, team systems that they're following through. There's so much important work that teams do with their coaches prior to events and making sure that these teams are prepared physically, mentally, making sure that their teams are working with the team dietitian, making sure that they're, you're really the person that makes sure that they're guiding through with their sports psychologist. They're working with their strength trainer. So there's a lot of roles that a coach needs to be following through with nowadays, and it's busy. And like I said, we've gone through a lot of changes within our system in the U.S. and now, fortunately, we've got a lot of great support staff in place that can help make the coaches' jobs easier. Back when I started in 2006, and as Kevin probably knows, coaching wasn't that prevalent. So you were really trying to do all those different things on my own and trying to navigate through it. Now there's a lot more support for coaches and, people with expertise in certain areas that can help to guide you. So it's there's a lot of work to be done pre-events and post-events, and then obviously in events, there's things, to make sure that everything flows as it should. And the athletes only really have to think about competing and playing when they're at events.
Let's talk a little bit about mixed doubles, because that's been the topic of the day here for the last couple of weeks. You were in Scotland with your team, and you guys had a bit of a struggle, tough game on Sunday in qualifying against the Czech Republic for Tabitha and Joe. But at the same time, I guess a little confusing, the U.S. national mixed doubles were taking place, which I guess we need to clarify. One of the main reasons for running the U.S. Mixed doubles nationals was to qualify some more teams for your trials. So you'd already qualified 3 from last year's 2020 U.S. nationals, and I believe 4 more were qualified on Sunday. The team that won the event on Sunday, Chris Plies and Vicky Persinger, are now the 2021 champions, and they will join the three qualifiers from last year along with three other teams. And you're going to have a qualifying, I believe, in October or the fall to bring in, what, three more teams? So the total is going to be 10. Is that correct?
Yeah, our Olympic trials will be 10 teams, and we'll have a qualifying event that's going to be in August and one in September, and then our Olympic trials will be, the dates haven't been set, but it'll be October to beginning of November.
So what's going to happen? And of course, you guys just barely missed qualifying out of Scotland, and so the U.S. has still got to qualify for the Olympics, and I'm assuming that event's going to be held, I'm hearing, in December. Is that what you're hearing?
Yeah, we're hearing it's going to be held in December, probably in the beginning parts of December. My guess, likelihood, is it's going to be somewhere in Europe, but they haven't confirmed a location for it yet at this point.
And I'm assuming that the winner of the U.S. trials is a team that will represent the United States in that playoff?
Yeah, we'll send our team that wins the Olympic trials, and you know, they'll go there and battle it out and work to earn their Olympic spot.
Just before I go over to Kevin, so how did you find that event in Scotland as far as working in a bit of a bubble there and the same type of thing in a competition? Was it up to your expectations, or were there any issues there that you felt from that week?
No, it was a great event, well run. As everything through this COVID pandemic, things have been challenging, things have been different. And, you know, the staff there at Aberdeen, Tom Brewster and, you know, the ice crew, did a fantastic job hosting us, and as good as you can do with what we were asked of. So no complaints there. The ice was great. You know, it had a lot of swing to it. You know, speed was, you know, anywhere from 14 to you know, 15 on a given day. So hog to hog. So, I mean, definitely happy with the event and the ice conditions and everything that everyone did to put together to host the event.
I want to walk back in time because, of course, you were part of the biggest win in U.S. curling history in Pyeongchang. But the start of that week in Pyeongchang, now, I was working with NBC, so I was paying close attention to your team. It didn't go well to start. We had John Schuster on the show here and listened to his side of things, but I'd love to hear it from behind the coach's eyes. I'm not sure if you guys were, what was it, 1-3, 1-4, like backs against the wall, pretty much had to win out. And then all of a sudden, the tides turned. I'd like to hear it from the coach's perspective.
Yeah, we were 2-4. And, you know, I think the interesting part about that time of the week was, you know, we were basically eliminated from the competition, although, you know, by all media sources and by everyone else, you know, 2-4, they're out of the competition. Nobody's talking about us, right? You know, we put a lot of processes in place in the 2018 games. As it was mentioned, I coached in the 2010 games, and I wasn't prepared to coach in Olympics at that point. I was young, I was inexperienced, and didn't have a lot of the skill set or tools to be able to help a team at that point. Fortunately, in the 2018 games, we had a great support staff. We had, you know, Carly Anderson as our sports psychologist. We had you know, myself, we had, you know, Derek Brown, and we had been through processes like this. We had been through Olympics. So one thing we did is we put in team systems that would, you know, no matter what happened, we followed through with our team systems. You know, we did our pre-games meetings the same way every day. We did our post-game meetings the same way, no matter if it was a win or a loss. And the most important thing that this team did was they trusted each other. They knew that they deserved to be there. They knew that they deserved an opportunity to win a medal. They had won a bronze medal in the 26 World Championships, 2016 World Championships. In 2017, they had finished fourth. So they knew that they were good enough to be there. If they could put things together, that we were good enough to get ourselves on the medal stand. And it was a matter of them believing in themselves. This team never gave up on each other. When they were sitting at 2-4, we sat in the post-game meeting after that loss to Norway, and we knew we had a fighting chance. We knew that we needed to believe in our processes, believe in what we were doing. And those guys, all three of them, you know, stood up for John. They stood on, you know, had John's back. And, you know, he was the guy that got us there, and they believed in him, from the coaching staff to the trainers to our sports psychologists. You know, I think it was an empowering moment of we've got you. You're our guy. Get us to where we need to go. And, you know, John did what he needed to do to get himself in the right spot mentally. We came out, we knew we had to play Canada in that next game. We were an underdog, obviously, playing Canada and sitting at 2-4. And we had nothing to lose. And I think it actually was a fortunate spot for us because we were playing a team that on paper in Olympic history, we had never beaten. Even though the pressure was probably really high, it was really off them because there were no expectations. Everyone thought they were out. So we told them to go out and play the game like they and have some fun with it. And, you know, don't let anybody else tell you when your tournament is done. Those are the specific things that, you know, we kind of started to build on is, you know, we'll be done when we decide we're done. And, you know, let's let that be when we can make ourselves to play on Saturday. And these guys just came out as a different team and they played relaxed. Beating Canada, you know, didn't turn us into a contender yet. We still had two huge games to go playing Switzerland and playing Scotland. But we knew that our fate was if we beat them, we dropped them down to the same record as us and we would all be 5-4 and we'd have the head-to-head to move above them and they would have to now play in a tiebreaker. So it just, everything fell into place. These guys started to play relaxed and the pressure wasn't there. And that was a huge part of our success is trusting the process.
Well, it was incredible.
Phil, one of the concerns always here that the boys have pointed out is, you know, about getting young people involved. It seems all our champions here in Canada are not the young kids. What's it like there?
Yeah, we've got some work to do just like every other country. We've done a great job in the last year of developing a U25 program. We found a gap, you know, as I think you guys did up in Canada and some other countries. But we have these curlers, these athletes that come out of juniors, and there's no place for them to go because all of a sudden, you know, on the men's side, you know, you look at they've got to go and compete against a John Schuster or a Rich Ruin, and it's tough to do that. So we needed to create a program that would help to develop athletes from 21 to 25. So we did that last year. We implemented the U25 program, and we've got we're continuing to develop that. But that is, you know, one of our first steps. We have a very strong junior program that we have, you know, that we've kind of revamped and adjusted the way we look at things and the way we do things. And one of the most important pieces that we've also set up is a developmental pool of athletes. So there, we had a program this year, which was, I think there was anywhere from 30 to 50 kids that were under 18 that were a part of this program that 1998 Olympian Mike Pepelinski ran. Most of these athletes didn't have ice even, and they stayed in tune for the entire winter. You know, they would get on once a month. He'd do a seminar with them. He'd send them out challenges, things that they could do off ice. And then the ones that did have ice, you know, they could, you know, go to the rink, tape their delivery, send it to him, get some analysis. So it was for the first year of the program, being in the middle of a pandemic, Mike did a fantastic job with it. It's going to be something that we can grow on. We're going to look at having camps for these athletes. So we see how important it is to be growing the game at the youth level. And I think these two new programs that we've started, I think are, you know, a step in the right direction.
When I was looking at the men's and women's nationals that are starting right away here, on the men's side, you've got some, I'm going to say older teams like our friends, of course, Todd Burr and Persinger and, of course, Rich Runen. But you've got the young teams, Corey, of course, Dropkin, excellent team out of Chaska, Scott Dunham out of Philadelphia, of course, Riley Fenson out of Chaska, and Luke Violette out of Chaska. So those are good young teams. And on the women's side, it's all youth, just about. You know, Madison Bear, of course, excellent. Corey Christensen, fantastic. McMacken, Rhyme, and Jamie Sinclair's not old by any means, but she's kind of the elder statesman now on the women's side. I guess I would like to hear your thoughts on this mass amount of young players, especially on the women's side, because that's really exciting to see.
It really is, and obviously we go through those changes, and we've lost a number of top female athletes over the last you know, 8 years to retirement. And to see these young female athletes, you know, wanting to get better, you know, wanting to put the time in. As you guys know, the game has changed a lot in the last 10 years, and it's a full-time commitment. You know, a lot of times these athletes are putting school on hold. They're putting life on hold. They're putting all these, they're moving to the Twin Cities, and, you know, all in hopes and dreams to win a national championship and to represent their country at a world championships and ultimately get on a medal stand. So it's great to see these youthful teams. We saw it in the mixed doubles nationals. If you looked at the final four, you know, we had Jenna Brzeski and Ben Richardson, you know, that ended up qualifying for the trials. We had Madison Bear and Andrew Sapera, who are our U-25 mixed doubles team that ended up losing the final to a veteran team of Chris Blies and Vicky Persinger. So our young athletes are showing up to play. Luke Violette teamed up with a veteran in Eileen Geving. So it's fun to see. It's fun to see these young teams put in the work and actually see it pay off for them, because then they can see that the things that they're doing, the, you know, going to the gym, you know, we're fortunate to have that partnership with the Twin Cities Orthopedics. Our athletes train right there at the training house in Eagan. And, you know, Mike Glenshin does a great job working with our athletes. They have like six training sessions a day that different athletes come to. And the interesting part about it is, Kev, you probably have experience with it. These younger athletes now are all training together. They might be on opposing teams, or they might end up playing each other for a junior national championship. But we have this unique thing going on where they're all now, a lot of them are in the Twin Cities area. They live together, but yet they're competing against each other. So it's kind of something that we certainly haven't seen something like that in the U.S. It's going to be interesting to see how to continue to watch this play out and to see how this can help our game.
Well, doesn't that kind of show your system now, because you've got so many young players and they realize that maybe they're not together right now, but being so young, there's a really good chance in a couple of years they could be teamed up together. Like, it's more of a Team USA concept than, you know, like a team Dropkin versus Team Fenson. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like that now. It seems to me anyways, a whole group of young players just trying to get really, really good. And by banging their own heads together, playing against each other, no problem. Because in the end, a lot of the top ones that get to the cream rises to the top, they end up being on the same team anyways.
Yeah, you're 100% correct. That's the whole culture of our program that we want to be developing, is a Team USA motto. Like, let's get better together. Let's push each other. Let's do everything we can to make each other better. We see that in particular, obviously, you know, me working with our men's program, you know, Rich Ruinen and John Schuster and Corey Dropkin are all good friends, right? And they'll even do the razzing on social media of each other. And, you know, they're pushing John Schuster to make sure he's getting better, because as you can see in the world rankings, and obviously we didn't have much of a season, but last year, you know, Corey Dropkin and Rich Ruinen were 14 and 15 in the order of merit. And they were ahead of John Schuster. So they're pushing at him. They're on his heels. And by having three teams like that pushing each other, it only makes you better.
Let's talk about how those teams are put together, Phil. And I think you do things a little different than probably in Canada. So your high performance committee, along with yourself and the other coaches, you work with those teams and sort of like who's going to play with whom, do you not?
Yeah, we help to guide the process. And, you know, we don't have the depth, obviously. You guys got a million or 2 million curlers up there. And so, you know, we help to work with them to figure out, you know, who's a good fit, who's best situated together. You know, if a team has an opening, who's the best person to fill that role. And, you know, myself in particular, we'll work with the team coach, we'll work with our sports psychologist to figure out, you know, let's make sure we get the right person in there, because as you guys know, it's not always about the person that makes the most shots. You also have to have a person that can fit in there and be a role player and fit the team chemistry. And you can have the four best shooters on a team and they may not have success on the world stage because they don't have that same team chemistry and the same team systems that can allow them to be successful.
That's great. As a matter of how you guys do it, I think that's one of the problems that we have in Canada. It's still being left to chance. And I think not enough calculation of who might fit best with who and which combination may work the best, and experimenting a bit to find those things out. Anyway, we talked about the U.S. mixed doubles, which just finished. And at this moment, the U.S. men's and women's nationals are taking place. And again, this is primarily to determine teams for your Olympic trials. And let me go through this and correct me if I'm wrong. But your trials are going to be six men's and six women's teams held in Omaha, I believe, in November. Two teams are already qualified, one men's, one women's, Schuster and Peterson, from being the 2020 champions. And out of this week, I believe you're going to qualify two more teams, and then there's going to be a playoff in the fall, I believe, to determine three others. Is that all correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And this week, I'm looking at who's playing here. I think from my point of view, on the women's side, I think Jamie Sinclair, Corey Christensen would be the two best picks. And I would think on the men's side, probably Ruinen and Dropkin. Would you stick your neck out to say yay or nay on that?
What I would say is on the women's side, we have a couple of, as Kevin talked about, there's some youth, and we have, Madison Bear's team has been working really hard, and we're fortunate to have Delaney Strauss, who's our current junior national champion, and who's done a lot of work. So, I think that the teams that you listed are the highest ranked on the order of merit, and they're going to be pushed on the women's side by those young teams. And obviously, on the men's side, there's Greg Persinger's been around for a while, and he's got Craig Brown on his team, Alex Leichter. They're a great team, and the Dunham team is a real solid team put together. And then you've got the young guys, obviously, with Luke Violette, Riley Fenson, that are going to be pushing them. So I think it's going to be a great, great week, and a lot of great action. I think these teams, whoever's going to win, is going to need to bring their A game, and be able to put together some good games, and be prepared to win at the end of the week.
I think of all those teams, the one that I would look at with the greatest potential and ready to break out of her shell is Corey Christensen. I think she's got the potential to be a great player. Do you agree on that one?
Yeah, I've had an opportunity to actually work with Corey in the past. Corey and Sarah and Taylor and Vicky, and those ladies are great players. They they've been right there knocking at the door. They've been close. Vicky obviously had a breakthrough last weekend winning the mixed doubles nationals. She's been right there when she used to play with Jamie Sinclair. So, Vicky's the veteran on the team. And those ladies have done a lot of work, and I'm excited to see them play this week. And, as well as Jamie, she's got a slightly new team, and her and Monica Walker are definitely veterans, and they've got a new young front end. It's going to be exciting to see what as we've talked about, and you guys have talked about, going into world championships, teams have played, 100 some games, it's generally the same prior going into national championships, as our national championships are usually held in February. They've played 100 games to prepare. And, in this case, they've maybe played, 10 to 15 scrimmage games. So anything certainly can happen.
Something that probably not too many people have noted, but I think maybe the first time ever in both the men's and women's worlds this year, the United States placed ahead of Canada. That's probably a first, is it not?
Yeah, I would say, we certainly noticed.
I'll bet you did.
it was a great, great to see our teams at the World Championships playing well. And, we're continuing to get better. And, Tab's team, bringing home a bronze medal was fantastic. I would have loved to seen, how the week would have finished out with John's team had the controversy not gone on and the issues that went with the World Championships. But it is what it is. And, we learn from it, and we make ourselves better from that. And, I was proud of the way those guys handled the situation, and, proud that they were able to come out and play in a quarterfinal game, and, have most of the world know that there wasn't much going on, and they ended up losing on the last shot. But they were really in a great flow, and I would have loved to have that game on Saturday morning when it was scheduled to have it, and see what kind of run John would have made. I believe he's poised to win a world championship, and when he can get that opportunity, and I'm hoping he gets that here sometime in the near future.
Right on, Phil. Keep up the passion, man. Great stuff. Curling needs more guys like you. Congratulations on your career so far, you know, in the coaching ranks, and obviously there's going to be bigger and better things to come for the States in when it comes to curling, for sure. Take it easy, Phil. Thanks again for coming on.
Hey, thanks a lot, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Well, Kev, what do you like when you hear Phil talk about the U.S. program?
I like the growth. I like how organized they are. I like the way they're looking at growing the game. The momentum in the U.S. is just really strong right now with opening up new clubs. And there's not much I don't like right now in what I see coming out of our Southern friends.
Warren, you've always said the U.S. program, one of the things that you do like is it doesn't have the stigma down in the U.S. of an old man's sport, that it's attracting young kids, Warren. What do you mean by that?
Well, I worked with the USACA for 3 years in sort of an advisor capacity with their events. And my experience was that younger people with the sport of curling in the United States overall are very curious about the sport, and they find it intriguing. And I can even remember last year we're at the University of Eastern Washington in Spokane, and we're on the campus. And some of these young people would come down. They wanted to touch the ice. They wanted to touch the rock, because we're fascinated by the whole thing. And so there's a little different attitude about the sport of curling in the United States than I think there is in Canada. Canada today, we dealt with the stigma for many, many years of it being kind of the old man's game, and they party a lot and so on. And while we have overcome a lot of that, it still is there in the background. But that type of thing is not prevalent in the United States at all. And it's a more a factor of curiosity, excited to want to try it, and in many cases, play it.
Come on, Warren. You're not talking about getting rid of the partying side of it, are you, for curling? Curlers are the best partiers in the world, man. That's why I fell in love with the game, Kev.
That's why you had a job. There wouldn't have been a briar patch.
Exactly. Let's get out of here, you guys. Okay, Inside Curling, we're reaching out to curling clubs all over the world, inviting you to contact us and ask me again about the partying at curling, okay? We'd love to sit down with you guys for an hour. We'll do it by Zoom. Please keep in mind it's on a limited basis that we're doing this, but if you'd like us to set that up, we've done over 8 or 9 of these now, and the clubs love it. And Kevin and Warren, I've sat through them, and they're fantastic, and they take all comers and all questions. So let's thank Rod Paulson and his company, In-House Strategies, out of Winnipeg, for all the great work on social media and the marketing, along with our team at Sportsnet. Our producer is Warren Hansen. I know that guy. Amal is the producer of the show. Our social media is done by Jonathan Brazzo, and our editing is done by Andrew Holland. So until next week, boys, Kev, let's hit the golf course here finally. Warren, you get out there too, and we'll talk about our games coming up next week. You've been listening to another episode of Inside Curling.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks, Jim.